It's Let's Talk Legal on the Talk Station, FM 107.1. And joining us this afternoon, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And as I begin the program, just to remind you, as you hear conversations and comments, feel free to call our host of the program, that's Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins, to get further information or clarification or maybe even to get some advice. I would recommend to you, don't hesitate to give them a call, 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050. And as of course, they do have their website at harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, please. harvellandcollins.com. And with that, Cecil, Wes, good afternoon.
Afternoon, Lockwood.
Cecil, good afternoon to you as well.
Good afternoon, Lockwood. Hello there.
And Wes, Cecil, what will be the topics of the day today?
Okay. Lockwood, I think that we're going to talk about the stages of litigation today. Wes, of course, leads his practice in the area of civil litigation. And I think it would be nice to kind of just review some of the stages of litigation. And so let's just go right out of the gate. I will say a word or two, and then I'm going to give it on over to Wes. But, you know, we don't just, Wes and his team, I mean, they just, a client doesn't just come in on a Monday and a lawsuit's filed, you know, the following week. Many times, as one would anticipate, there are letters back and forth, possibly. There's discussions. There's opportunity to resolve the conflict that has arisen. And certainly we attempt to do that. But the day may come when it's obvious, and sometimes it is at the beginning, but many times not, that there's just no choice but to proceed with a lawsuit. And so kind of the question out of the gate, Wes, is, well, what is that? What is a lawsuit? What does that mean?
Wes?
Right. So just walking through the steps of litigation, and we can fill in the gaps as we talk about what the different steps are, is that, you know, a typical lawsuit, and there are different types of lawsuits and quasi-lawsuits. You've heard us talk about Lockwood, petitions to partition, well, that's a filing of a particular petition where you file with the court. That's a kind of a lawsuit. There's foreclosure actions. That's a kind of a lawsuit. There are arbitration-type proceedings. That's kind of a quasi-lawsuit litigation-type thing as well. But your typical lawsuit is going to be like a plaintiff versus defendant or defendants, and it's going to be about, you know, whatever it is. It could be a motor vehicle accident, which is probably a negligence claim, almost certainly a negligence claim. It could be a contract case. It could be a business case as far as a business agreement, partnership. It could be, you know, tort-based claim like an assault. Battery, it could be a slander-based claim, it could be any type of claim. You know, if the facts and the evidence would support the claim, then and we're at a point where litigation is the only way to hopefully reach a resolution, that starts by filing the complaint. Mm-hmm. And it's the summons and the complaint. Now, the summons is issued by the court, and the summons basically is what, you know, most people think it is. I've been summoned. That means you're under the jurisdiction of the court. You've got to come to court. And so the filing of the lawsuit is the first thing that happens. And kind of going off what Cecil said, you know, it doesn't necessarily happen that a client comes in on a Monday and on a Tuesday morning we're filing a lawsuit. Sometimes we have to move very quickly because of maybe a statute of limitations issue or something like that. But the preparation of this complaint that gets filed is is a process, and it has to be, you know, proper in all respects. It's not a simple form that gets filed. So we have to spend a lot of time on getting that correct. So filing the complaint is what happens first. Then the summons is issued, and then there has to be service. And when we say service, that means that the defendants have to be served the summons and the complaint. They have to be, I mean, this could be by the sheriff. Mm-hmm. It could be by a process server. It could be by, under certain rules, registered mail. In the event that there is difficulty in having the defendant served because we can't find them, maybe they're in another state or whatever, and we've exhausted all efforts, then we can go to service by publication. This is where we place the notice of the lawsuit in the publication, the newspaper, mm-hmm. of the in the area, the last known residence address of the defendant or defendants. If we haven't been able to search, now we can't do publication from the beginning. We have to do these other types first and try to make a good faith effort to serve them directly as opposed to by publication first. So that's like a last ditch effort. So here we are. We filed the complaint. The summons has been issued by the court. The summons is still alive, and you have basically, there's a lot of rules here, but 90 days to have that summons served. And if you don't have it served within 90 days, then you have to make sure you get it extended by the court.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's an important thing to do. You lose that right if you don't have it extended within there's a 60-day time frame and then a 90. A lot of detail there. But anyway, we serve the person, and then once they're served, the next time frame we're dealing with is, depending on what kind of lawsuit it is, they have a period of time to file their responsive pleading to the complaint. Okay, and in state court, North Carolina, that's a 30-day period. So, and right there on the front of the summons, the yellow sheet of paper that's served, it says something like, you know, warning, a lawsuit has been filed against you, and you have 30 days to respond. So it's really clear and bold writing and so on and so forth. So
let me interrupt you here for a moment, Wes. And again, we're talking with Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins, and we're talking about the steps of litigation. The question I have for you, Wes, is the response. What is the purpose of the response on the part of the person being served, in the sense that obviously a suit has been filed, let's say, against me, I have the opportunity to respond, but what is the purpose of the response? Is that to somehow deny there's a valid reason for a lawsuit or something of this nature? So what I guess is final question, what is the purpose of the response?
Yeah, great. Great question. The purpose of the response is to provide an answer to each of the allegations in the complaint.
Okay.
Okay, where you've got each of these allegations. Remember I said a moment ago that there would be different types of claims that are pled out in the complaint.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when you have those different types of claims pled out in the complaint, then there will be specific allegations that we have to have in order to support those claims. If the complaint doesn't have the right allegations in it, then the complaint could get dismissed by the court because you have to plead what's called a prima facie case, which is just the basic elements.
Mm-hmm.
So those basic elements and factual support for those, the actual allegations for those, will be... that's when the answer, or the responsive pleading that you asked about, that's when the defendant has the opportunity to come forward and admit whether allegation number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, you know, 10, 20, however many, admit them or deny them, or say that, you know, basically I don't know for lack of information and belief, therefore denied. So you get to respond to what those allegations are. You also, this is the appropriate time when you file your answer to raise affirmative defenses. Now, yeah, this is where we get into, I mean, all of this when we're talking about filing an answer, it's usually not a good idea to do this without an attorney.
Oh, my goodness, yes, no question about that.
You know, number one, if you miss your deadline, you're going to have a default problem. And that kind of ends the lawsuit prematurely, or it could. So you have to file your answer in a timely manner. And then if you fail to respond to the allegations in an appropriate way, then you could be subject to what's called a judgment on the pleadings. That means the court can enter a judgment against you based on how you answered. Okay? A lot of detail there. But then we get to the affirmative defenses. I mean, let's say that the lawsuit got filed too late and the statute of limitations applies. Well, a statute of limitations is an affirmative defense, and that means if you don't raise it, you waive it.
Okay.
Yeah, so that can be very dangerous, you know, for a defendant if they fail to raise that in their response of pleading, that they may breathe life into a lawsuit that otherwise should not go forward because the statute of limitations would bar the rights, you know, to go forward. So the response of pleading is very important in the context of being able to properly respond to the allegations in the complaint, to raise affirmative defenses, and to also bring counterclaims. Okay, plaintiff, you've sued me because you say that I didn't pay you for the work you did on my house.
Right.
Okay. Defendant says, well, I'm countersuing you, and the reason I didn't pay you is because you did a poor job.
Right.
So here we are in the dispute, but that counterclaim would need to be raised in the pleading.
Okay.
Or it could be there is a cross claim against a third party where, okay, plaintiff, you're suing me. Defendant says, okay, well, I'm suing you back, and if I'm responsible, it's because this other guy did it, so I'm bringing him in too. So we could have, you know, some third party practice there as well, where we're bringing in, you know, some other individuals, other corporations, you know, depending on the circumstances.
I'm going to get to a real quick question on the issue of third party here for a quick, just a second, and I'm going to want to pause here for a moment and remind folks that we're listening to a program here, Let's Talk Legal with Wes Collins. That's who we're hearing, of course, of Harvell and Collins, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins. And as we continue the program, I just want to remind you, don't hesitate to give the folks at Harvell and Collins a call, 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050. We're talking again with Wes Collins today, particularly, and Cecil, I know, is listening in, the steps of litigation. And Wes, a moment ago, you introduced the third party in the case of a litigation. If a third party is named or identified in, you know, either the response to the initial filing of a particular, let's say, for example, a failure to fulfill on a contract.
Right.
Does that require a separate litigation document?
It does. You're thinking correctly, Lockwood, because we're bringing in another party. You know, so think about this. The plaintiff who's filed this lawsuit has subjected himself to the jurisdiction of the court by filing a lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
We have gotten jurisdiction over the defendant by serving them, as I talked about, the summons and complaint. So we can't just, if we're the defendant, then bring in a third party kind of willy-nilly and say, come join the party.
Right.
Without also having a summons issued as to that third party, so and also serving the summons and the response of pleading, which would be the cross claim you know, against that third party. So yeah, you've got to make sure you've got all of these technical issues taken care of, or you could end up with, you know, a lawsuit that ends up being a big problem, you know, and maybe just goes away because you didn't comply with the rules.
I can see a spaghetti, as my description, a spaghetti of lawsuits. This brings me all back to one quick question at the opening of our conversation, Wes. And again, Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins with us this afternoon. Wes, in the case of a client coming to you expressing interest or feeling they needed to initiate a lawsuit against an individual or corporation, I'm thinking, though you mentioned, of course, it just doesn't happen overnight. Of course, you have to concern yourself with, as you mentioned, statute of limitations. And I'll ask you a question about that a little later on. But in the process of starting this lawsuit, there's a certain degree, I would assume, of Q&As on your part to determine the validity of this lawsuit, but also the complexity of the lawsuit, such as are there third and fourth parties involved, things of that nature. So there's a little bit more than just myself walking in and saying, I want to sue XYZ Corporation. Am I correct on that?
No doubt about it. I would say the majority of the lawsuits that I'm involved in are fairly complex.
Wow.
There's a lot of estate-related litigation that we do. There's a lot of, you know, contract-related litigation. I would say some of the easier, not easier, but less complex cases that we deal with, which I don't do a ton of, but personal injury cases, your negligence claim is going to be based on a pretty isolated event,
right?
It's an accident. We have the incident report from the investigating officer, so we see what their position is as far as what happened, and we generally know what the damages were. You know, we know what condition our client is in, so we're able to plead those things based on a particular occurrence on a particular date. Okay, so that's a little bit simpler.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, there's a significant interview process, and it could be, you know, multiple things, because, you know, I will oftentimes sit down with a client and get the basic information, and they'll, you know, decide to hire us to go forward with it. I will, and then they'll provide further information to me, and I will review that, and then I'll get them to come back in, and then, you know, after reviewing the further information, that will raise further questions in my mind I need to interview them about before we go and complete the complaint that we're filing.
Right.
So, yeah. So we're at the point where we file the lawsuit, and then we've gotten it served, and there's a responsive pleading. And then all of the pleadings, as we say, are then done. Okay, they're in the court. They're filed. And then we move into, in most cases, the discovery process. And because, you know, I know what I know about the case,
right,
but I don't necessarily have everything that I need in order to prove my case. This could be a case about, for example, you know, someone taking advantage of an elderly person and having beneficiary designations changed right before they died. I mean, it could be a case like that. Well, what are the things that I'm going to want with regard to that? Well, I'm going to want to know any witnesses, anyone who has any knowledge about the relationship between the person who got the beneficiary designation changed and the older person. I'm going to want to know people who are around the older person who could testify about what condition he or she was in. I'm going to want the medical records of that person to see if, you know, there's a dementia or Alzheimer's or any kind of lack of capacity presentation in the medical records. I'm going to want to get bank records to see if there's any other activity that's questionable. You know, so this, I just rattled off five things right there that I know that in this relatively complex litigation, I'm going to need to get through discovery. And those things don't just show up on my doorstep on day two after I've asked for them on day one.
Yeah.
I have to get HIPAA authorizations for medical records. You know, I have to get the proper authorization signed so I can get the information. you know, from medical records wise or bank records wise. And, you know, so we get these come in, you know, over time, or maybe they don't come in, and then I've got to follow back up, or maybe I've got to file a motion to compel to go to court to require these to come in. And then, obviously, when this evidence comes in, I have to keep it, you know, very organized, mm-hmm. so it's useful to me. If it's not organized, it's not going to be useful to me.
You know, the question or statement you made a moment ago about the issue of authorization, say HIPAA forms and things of this nature, how do you get does the authorization come from the court? Is that something I'll use the term court order? What are some of the procedures for having to get the authorization? Obviously, family members, you need you need documentation proving that you do represent those family members. But as you mentioned a moment ago, HIPAA forms sometimes are restricted, very restricted.
Depends on who I represent. I mean, let's say that the records that I need are the records of the deceased, which mm-hmm. under the scenario I just gave you is that's the typical situation. You know, if the deceased is the person who was taken advantage of, I'm most interested in the records of the deceased. I might be interested in the records of the person who did the deceptive act mm-hmm. because I want to see what went into their account. You know, I want to kind of follow the money. But be that as it may, let's talk about the records of the deceased. Well, if I represent the estate, okay, then the personal representative or the administrator, executor of the estate has full authority to be able to sign whatever I need.
Okay.
So I can go to the executor and say, okay, I need this HIPAA authorization signed.
Okay.
I need this release signed so I can get the medical records. Now, let's say I don't represent the estate. Well, I send a discovery request to the estate.
Okay.
Okay, if they're a party, and I'm asking them to either provide the records to me or to sign an authorization for me to get them. And if the issue of if the medical records are relevant, then the court is going to make the party do that.
Okay.
They're going to make the estate do that. But it could take 60, 90 days because I have to give them an opportunity to give it to me first. So it's, you understand, you're kind of, you're starting to understand why litigation takes so long.
You know,
I mean, there's balls up in the air in every case all the time. And you just have to, you know, be able to juggle those really well.
All right. I mentioned a few moments ago, I was going to ask you about this issue of statute of limitations. And let's say, for example, statute of limitations for a particular case and whatever it might be, is the end of this week. And you've looked at the complexity of the case. And as you just pointed out, this case is going to take well over 60, 90, maybe even a full year. Under the statute of limitations, does the clock stop ticking when you file the case, or you know, what happens in some of those instances?
Yes. Once you filed it, you're good to go.
Okay.
But you need to make sure you filed every claim
Ooh.
That applies. Because let's say that you failed to plead a proper claim that should have been brought at the beginning.
Whoa.
And then you try to amend after the statute of limitations to bring that claim. That certainly is going to invite an argument, you know, from the defense on that, and you have to make sure that you have sued the proper, you know, party as well.
Mm-hmm.
We have a case currently where it was after the statute of limitations where the client came to us, but we filed a particular insurance company. This is a hurricane case,
right?
And we sued the insurance company based on the name on all the documents, okay, but we had a reason to file it after the statute of limitations. They are stopped from raising the statute of limitations because of some of the things the insurance company did. But be it as it may, the insurance company raised the issue that we did not name the proper subsidiary,
mm-hmm.
which is basically just a trap because they have like 100 different subsidiaries under this large umbrella. Well, it'd be impossible, basically, for a plaintiff I mean, what are we going to name all 100 subsidiaries? Mm-hmm. No, we don't have to do that. So at any rate, you know, we are having to amend to now name this proper party, and we've done that. But then they're still going to try to get the case dismissed based on us naming the party that was more of the umbrella party as opposed to this subsidiary where it wasn't even clear that that's who the responsible defendant would be. I would call it a little bit of an insurance company trick, if you ask me.
Okay.
But you understand, you have to really try to dot your I's and cross your T's when you file that complaint, even if you have a very little time to get it ready.
Mm-hmm. It's important, I think, for the audience to recognize, as you said earlier, this takes a lot of time, but time also can be a critical issue, as you mentioned, with the statute of limitations. I just wanted to make mention of that observation. Again, we're talking with Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins, and we're talking about the steps of litigation. Wes, back to the topic, and I apologize for jumping in on that one on the issue of timing, but after the discovery process, what's the time frame? What are we looking for in the discovery process for time?
Discovery can last a long time. I mean, it could be 6 months, you know, easily, and it could be that, you know, the written discovery part where we're serving our discovery request, getting in the responses, going to court to get additional items under a motion to compel, you know, that could take, you know, the better part 6 months or a year. And then once we have those, normally that's when we're going forward to the next step of the discovery, which would be taking the depositions that we feel that we need.
Mm-hmm.
We now have the documents, so we need to now talk to the people, you know, and take their deposition, you know, that we feel like are necessary. So that's a process in and of itself, getting attorney schedules ordered and in order, and getting the you know, the witness lined up, court reporter lined up, so on and so forth, and you know, doing all that. Once we've done that, then normally one of the next things that happens once we really have completed discovery is we're either going to be at a point where we mediate the case, which is where the case is ordered to mediation, where an attorney is designated as the mediator who meets with the parties and tries to get them to see each other's side to reach a resolution. That could happen at this point, or it could happen earlier. It mm-hmm. certainly could happen earlier if the parties agree to it. Or it could happen, you know, after a motion, you know, dispositive motions like a motion for summary judgment, which could make the case go away.
Right.
You know, it could resolve the case completely. So, you know, we're kind of at the point now where, you know, we're kind of working our way from a very broad end of the funnel down to the narrow end of the funnel. Because when we start this process, the broad end of the funnel kind of captures everything. And then as we move forward, there's the issues get narrowed and narrowed and narrowed to the point where, you know, okay, this is really what the case is about, and this is what we're trying there at the narrow end of the funnel. So once we've, you know, mediated and the case didn't settle and we're through dispositive motions, then the court is going to be very interested in when we try the case. They're going to want to put us on the trial calendar if we're not already on the trial calendar, set the case for trial, and then we're, you know, kind of being, speaking broadly here today, but getting ready for trial in and of itself is quite a process. Not just all of this year or year and a half of leading up to it, but the weeks before the trial, you know, there's preparation of a pretrial order. There's, you know, you're getting your subpoenas out to your witnesses you need at trial. There's strategizing, you know, with regard to the pleadings and, you know, what is really before the court and preparing your opening statement, you know, preparing your voir dire, your questioning of the potential jurors, you know, preparing for your direct examination, dealing with evidentiary issues on a motion in limine to limit evidence that's irrelevant that shouldn't come in. So there's just a whole lot of moving parts all in a very short period of time, at the very end of this long process of preparing for the trial itself, that, you know, the strategy involved kind of just comes to this point where, you know, it's pretty much like what go time. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's go time. And you kind of, when you get to that point as an attorney, you know, if you're a good litigator, then you kind of have to shut everything else out.
Right.
You just have to focus on this because you just spent the past year and a half of your life getting ready for this case.
Not
to mention there's a lot of other cases.
Exactly, I was going to say. And this is not the only case you're dealing with.
No, again,
we're talking with Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins, and it's the steps of litigation. You know, Wes, as we wrap it up with you this afternoon, and of course we're now at that point of court. Now maybe we'll talk about this again going forward. The whole issue of the time associated with this, and as you just mentioned, not being the only case you're dealing with, and you have to focus in. Real quick question: how do you arrange your time to do that?
Oh my goodness, it's not. I really enjoy trying the case itself because,
right,
you know, we put all this work into it, put a ton of thought into it, a lot of conversation in the office about it, a lot of prep, a lot of research, and, you know, I pretty much in my mind know exactly how I think the case should go
mm-hmm.
before I start because I get very well prepared. That's just the way that I do things.
Right.
But what I don't like about that is that once you spend all that time preparing and then you go try the case, well, when you're in the trial itself, you're not able to respond to your emails
right.
or move other files forward at all.
Right.
So you get so far behind
Whoa.
as an attorney, and you have to communicate with your clients and let them know that, look, when your case is ready for trial, I'm going to be 100% laser focused
Understood.
On your
yeah.
case, but I've got to win this one right now.
I think
you know. So it's frustrating as to how because you know you got to rely upon your associates as well,
mm-hmm.
your younger lawyers to move things forward. It just because you know Mr. Collins is in trial doesn't mean that things don't move forward
right.
at the proper pace, and so you rely upon your staff. So
yeah.
it can be pretty stressful, not only the trial itself, but the effect of being out of the office and fully engaged in one case for you
wow.
know sometimes a week or longer. That can be a challenge.
I think that's an important observation, and I want to thank you, Wes. And you're sharing some information and background information that most of us never consider. Again, we're talking with Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins, and Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins can be reached at 252 area code 726-9050. And of course, I want to remind you, you can go online, and I would strongly recommend doing so because it'll give you an idea of background on the whole firm at harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, please, harvellandcollins.com. And with that, to you, Wes and Cecil, thanks for the
yes.
program this afternoon.
Thank you, Lockwood.